You are listening to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. As part of our free market environmentalism workshop, this episode features Robin Hansen presenting on information markets for environmental services.
So decision markets are something that is very ambitious, and if they can work, they can do spectacular things, but there are some reasons why they can't fully work, and that's what we're going to get into. So this you should all know. For a long time, people have traded stuff. That doesn't really show up there. I don't think so. Stuff for money, stuff that's durable, portable, et cetera, and that has created a price. And that price has often fluctuated, gone up or down. And when price goes up or down, that induces some people to come in and think, gee, I could make this money off of this. I could turn this into a money pump because if I can anticipate that it's going to go up, I buy today and sell tomorrow. If I anticipate it's going to go down, I sell today and buy tomorrow. Either way, I walk away with money. All I have to do to turn this into a money pump is to figure out which way the price is going to go. So that attracts lots of people to try to do that. And they try to look at all sorts of patterns in the past, how the price has changed. Does it go up on Mondays? Does it go down when the other price goes down, et cetera? Whenever they find a pattern, they see that it goes up on Mondays. They find a way to take advantage. They buy on Sundays. They sell on Tuesdays. They walk away with cash, but they make the pattern go away in the process. So price doesn't go up on Mondays as much if they come and buy on Sundays and sell on Tuesdays. And so in the process, speculative market prices end up embodying a lot of information, not all possible information, but such that it's hard to find information that they don't embody, such that it's hard to go find these opportunities to make money. So that's a key, powerful feature of an institution we've known for a long time. Speculative markets aggregate information. And we can use that on purpose if we create an asset, say, that's tied to an event that we're interested in. This is pays a dollar if Obama wins the next election. And if we can get people to trade that for cash, then the price of that they pay for that becomes an estimate that embodies lots of information about the future value of that asset, i.e. a dollar or zero, so it becomes a good estimate of the probability of him winning the election. So that's a powerful technique that we can use by putting something there and writing what we want on the piece of paper if we can get people to trade it. These are some prices from Intrade on a variety of world events of interest to you, various defaults in Europe, cap and trade in the US, et cetera. And the point is, you look at these prices and you say, do those look reasonable? If any of these look wrong, you are invited to go make money by correcting them, going to Intrade, betting on it. In the process, you will expect to make money and these things will get corrected. And so when you look at these and you say, no, I don't want to trade on them, you are basically saying, well, I guess I'm going to grant that they have a lot of information and I'm not going to stick my neck out and say they're wrong, which suggests that they have a lot of information. Over the last dozen years or so, people have done some specific tests where at the same time they had a speculative market forecasting something and they had some other familiar mechanism forecasting something. And they compared at the same time similar people and resources devoted to those two ways of forecasting. And consistently, the speculative markets do as well or better. So that's the main empirical claim, that speculative markets are good at aggregating information compared to other familiar institutions like committees, expert selection, polls, etc. There are lots of theoretical arguments why this might be true, but I want to weigh most of my argument on the empirical claim that, in fact, when we test it, it works out. So some examples, Iowa electronic markets where they've had forecasts on elections. So over, roughly 1,000 times when you can compare polls in the markets were closer to the answer, and they don't respond to various media events, et cetera, like you might think, like the polls do. And they're even doing some flu markets in the same group of people where they're estimating what things are happening in where there will be flus and therefore where there will be needs for flu supplies, personnel, et cetera. And over the last half dozen years, hundreds of companies have tried to introduce these inside their firms. They have tried to forecast things like sales, project completion dates, things that other firms are doing, trying to take advantage of this on purpose to say, we want to know something. There are people around who might know. Let's create a speculative market, look at the price, and use that as our estimate of the answer. There's huge potential here, but now I want to be honest about what actually goes on. So if you actually want to do this, the main criteria are really very simple. People get caught up into the market mechanisms and various kinds of complications, but the real issues are you need to have a question you actually want to know the answer to. You'd be surprised how difficult that is. A question that you won't mind other people seeing the answer if it's not such an attractive answer. You won't mind looking bad. That you won't mind lots of people knowing this answer, and you need there to be people who might know something about this. You don't have to be sure they know, but you have to collect some people who might know something about your question. There might be just a few of them, that's fine. And you need to be able to give these people some incentives so that they can participate. Now, cash markets works, but there are other sorts of ways to give incentives, and the key thing is that people just have to care enough. And then in addition, if you're trying to do a test to see if it works, i.e. rather than use it, maybe you need a short time scale and a lot of numbers so you can get some statistics to show that it works. But basically, if you want to do a prediction market in an organization, these are the key criteria. If you meet these, then you're pretty golden. Then we can set it up, and I work with companies that do this. But here's what typically happens, just sort of as an aside for a bit. Somebody puts on the mantle of innovator and says, I will do prediction markets. They are the great leader. They decide, okay, let's do it. What questions are we going to do? And then we consult with them. We say, well, gee, in your organizations, these look like really important questions. That would give you a lot of value. And they say, oh, no. That's too politically sensitive. And they try to go somewhere else where something seems safe and comfortable, and maybe people can get involved and feel they're part of something. And then they have markets on that, and they usually get accurate forecasts, more accurate than their other mechanisms if they have a comparison, satisfied users. But even so, with all these accurate forecasts, people go, yeah, but why did we want to know that? Because they didn't actually ask the question that mattered a lot. They asked the safe questions. And then the champion moves on, he gets promoted, et cetera, and there's a lack of interest and it dies. Or maybe it still continues, but at a modest level of interest. So there's a real problem in organizations that, although this is a mechanism that gives information, you can prove that it gives them information, they are still have a puzzling level of disinterest. So in fact, when you go try to sell prediction markets to individual firms and you say, this will give you more accurate forecasts, they usually don't challenge that claim. They usually don't even ask for data supporting that claim. They usually accept the claim that it will give them more accurate forecasts. Nevertheless, they say, yeah, not interested. And this is also true. Other sorts of things that give information, like randomized experiments, et cetera, are commonly not done in organizations, even though you might think they would. In fact, funding or forecasting organizations are usually quite underfunded and paid poor attention to. We have some understanding of why these things happen. Often it's bad to create up a system that will give a track record when you have a failure that people ahead of time said there would be a failure. So maybe it's better off to say, who could have known? Nobody said anything. We'd never anticipated this, and so it's good to make sure there's no such track record. Often people get the reputation for being a clearinghouse of information, saying, I'm the guy who knows the right people to talk to, and then this would replace them in that way. And often people gain advantage by manipulating perceptions on projects that we just might make the deadline if we all pull together. And if it's pretty clear that we will or we won't make the deadline, then we don't all pull together. And so they're trying to manipulate perceptions about what's going to happen. So it's important. Put out the theory that, in fact, most managers are politicians, not the great scientific decision maker that business schools let them on to be. They have to put together coalitions in support of things. Then once they've got a coalition, they don't want to dump it for some last-minute fluctuation in forecasts. They want to keep going with their coalition. So that makes it hard to field things like prediction markets in organizations. We need organizations that are actually somewhat desperate to actually know something and are willing to take chances and risk the organizational structure to actually find things out. And that's somewhat rare, but the field is growing. And just like with cost accounting, maybe eventually, if it becomes a standard, people will be too embarrassed not to do it because it will suggest something bad about your organization that you don't want to know what's actually going on. Well, we aren't there now, so we're in this situation. And if this is how bad it is in private firms, you can guess how bad it is in government policy, right? It's going to be even harder to convince government policy organizations, large policy organizations, to use prediction markets to forecast key outcomes of policies. But nevertheless, now that I've said all that, well, last thing to say is this is part of a larger research agenda where I've realized that a lot of things aren't what they seem. Started out in health economics, where medicine isn't about health, et cetera. And here in organizations, management isn't about decision making, it's more about coalitions. But I'll set that aside for the moment, and let's just go back to pretending like we always do that, in fact, our customers do want information and are looking for ways to do it. And for a while here, we'll just go back to that mode of pretending that, in fact, we're trying to solve the problem, that the problem they want is this problem of how to get better information. So if you're trying to get better information, it's an institutional comparison question We want to say, on the same sort of problems, which institutions do better? So if you tell me, well, prediction markets did really bad on this topic, so therefore they aren't any good, I'll say, well, what did something else do on that topic? Show me something else that did better, then we have a conversation. If you say it just did bad on a topic, maybe I'll say that's a hard topic. For this institution, users will make some sort of contributions, and out of it we'll get some forecasts, and we can also, as a side effect, or as a main effect, if you will, get some way to rank people in terms of their insight, and we can get people engaged. And often these are the priorities in many of these firm projects, is to produce firm engagement and letting people feel that they're heard and listened to, and they don't actually care about the forecast, unfortunately. But as a mechanism, prediction markets are numerically precise. They don't just give you a bunch of weasel words. They give you actual numbers as estimates, probabilities, et cetera. If we have a bunch of prediction markets on different topics, you'll give you a consistent answer across all of them. Arbitrage will insert that. Turn out, they'd be typically frequently updated. They're hard to manipulate. We can discuss that if you like. And you can collect a lot of people and not have to know who are the experts, really. You can have people you think might know, but if you turned out to be wrong, not a big deal. When you put together a committee, usually if you have half of them be bozos, it's a problem for the committee. But here, half of the participants being bozos is not a problem for prediction markets, because they will mostly sit down and shut up like they should in the committee, what they don't. So now I want to focus more on a particular kind of prediction market that's not very widely applied now, but has much bigger potential, I think, to advise policy both within private organization and at larger national and international levels. So here in a few minutes, I will give a more specific description of what I mean. But here, let's imagine there's a particular policy proposal on being considered for stricter air quality standards. So that's what we mean by cleaner air here. And if we wanted to bet on whether this bill would be passed, we could create an asset that says pays $1 if cleaner air. And then if we look at the price people pay for that asset, how many dollars that they require for that, we get an estimate of the chance that the bill will pass. And similarly, of course, the chance that it won't pass. Now, if we create another asset that says lifespans in the U.S., say, if it's a U.S. policy, will go up over a certain time period, this pays $1 if that happens, and if the Clean Air Bill is passed, we have people exchange that for here. The price trading here, you can see, both of these assets are worth nothing if we don't pass this bill. But if we do pass this bill, the trade ratio here is to set by what in fact the lifespan will be under that situation. And similarly down here, the trade ratio is an estimate of the probability of lifespan if we don't pass this bill. So if we have these two markets and we can compare these prices, we would basically get a signal from speculators about what they think the effect of this bill will be on this outcome, cleaner air on lifespan. We can do that not just with binary outcomes like this. We can instead have an asset that pays in proportion to some number. So if there's some number like lifespan is 78 years, then this pays $78. And if lifespan is 76 years, then this pays $76. So we can have an asset like that. Then we can get an expected value. That is, we can get markets to give us an expected value of a number, of an outcome of interest, conditional on choosing a policy. And we can compare that to the expected value of the outcome if we don't choose the policy. And those two numbers could give us a direct market estimate of the consequence of a policy. So we can do a lot of things in government. For example, we could talk about a single payer health plan and whether that would increase lifespan. We could talk about various Fed policies and how that would affect some combination of unemployment and inflation, et cetera. We could talk about vouchers and how that would affect test scores. We could do security tests. We could talk about which candidate in the upcoming election would be best for various outcomes in the economy, like unemployment. And we can apply this to within firms, to key firm decisions like whether to fire a CEO, all through the same simple mechanism of having outcomes that we can tell about what policy we chose and then some outcomes we're interested in that we can see after the fact. So this is an example from 2008 from Intrade. If you have markets in the probability of somebody being nominated, and you also have a market in the probability that they'll eventually win, to divide the two numbers, you get a conditional probability of them winning if they're nominated. And you could think of that as advice to the party, hey, if you nominate this person, there's a better chance of them actually winning the election. So this slide contains a lot of bullet points where the paper I distributed, I apologize, but the paper I did eventually distribute focuses on these points in a lot more detail. So this isn't a cure-all. It can do fantastic things in the right circumstance, but it doesn't do everything. So we need some requirements to make this work. One is we need legal permission to actually make trades, and that's actually a serious problem because of anti-gambling laws. In addition, for public policy, we need some public credibility, some reason why, even though we economists say might defer to speculative market prices as good estimates, public does not yet do so. And until they do so, they might not be very persuaded by these things, and therefore policymakers might not be very inclined to follow that lead. In addition, we need an outcome or several outcomes that can be measured, such as lifespan, such as cost, et cetera. It's good to have these be large aggregate outcomes so that no one saboteur could go destroy them for money, but that's usually the case. It helps to be linear enough in the thing you're interested in and conditional enough. So, for example, if you have a project and the question is whether the project will make the deadline, and if you have a betting market on will we make the deadline, if you just do that without other conditions, then there's the possibility that because you said you're not going to make the deadline, they go redefine the project so they have a better chance of making the deadline, and then you have given good information, but you've punished the people who gave you the warning. It's better then to make a conditional estimate by saying, if we don't change the project definition, then we won't make the deadline. But if we do change the project definition in some way, then you can get other forecasts. So that's when you want to have conditional enough on the various possible actions. You need some decisions that are distinct and clear. So firing the CEO is a nice, clear, distinct decision. Which president we elect is a clear, distinct decision. Perhaps passing a particular bill in Congress is a clear, distinct decision. But a lot of things government agencies do and policymakers do end up being a mix and muddle of various things that are hard to separate and anticipate and even measure ahead of time. And in those cases, it'll be much harder to have a betting market say, if we reform finance, then, well, what does reform finance mean exactly? You know, you'll need to anticipate the categories of possible reforms enough so that you could specify if a reform of this sort is adopted, then, and you could just get it wrong about how you categorize the possible options you might have. You need these options not only to be distinct, you need to be important enough so that they make a big enough difference. So clearly we could put a stop sign, an extra big stoplight on an intersection down here, and that will have some effect on traffic accidents in Bozeman, but if we do a national market on national mortality, it's just not going to see the effect of putting a traffic light on the street here. We need the options we're considering to be substantial enough that they could plausibly have an impact, a measurable, noticeable impact on the outcomes we're looking at. We need to have some traders that we can get access to for public policy. It would be some matter of, you know, making it legal and then, if necessary, subsidizing these markets. There are ways to do that so that informed traders have an extra incentive to trade. You don't have to rely just on people doing it for fun. You can be willing to pay for the information. If you pay for it, you get the information you pay for, and then you could get more accurate information. And for large policy outcomes, it's quite plausible that we should be willing to spend millions of dollars subsidizing markets to get good information about key public policy questions. So here's a concrete example I was struck by. So I teach health economics, and whenever I see various measures of things that affect health, I'm usually struck by how little things affect health for most policies. But air quality is one of the ones that is really an exception. So a large number of studies suggest there's really quite a large effect of air quality on health. And so, for example, a recent 2006 paper, I give a cite here, lists a bunch of other papers, and it said roughly a 7% effect on mortality, which is a year of life, from the following proposals. So if there's the PM 2.5, particles of less than 2.5 microns, the EPA national average standard. It's now 15.0. If we change that to 10.0, these papers suggest we would give people an average of a year of life, which is a lot. It's hard to imagine that that cost would be so large as not to justify that, if you can believe that number. But can you believe that number is the key point. So people might have an incentive to overplay these things, to yell too much about problems. You know, maybe they're selecting data, maybe they're looking at a correlation that wouldn't be affected by this policy as much. But we could imagine doing a prediction market, a decision market, on this particular thing. We say, if we change this policy from 15 to 10 within the next 2 years, say, then on whatever time scale you think, and it's actually pretty quick over a five-year time scale, the mortality would change, then what would be the mortality? So you could have a market estimating U.S. mortality conditional on this change in air quality, and you could then get an authoritative, I would claim, a reliable, authoritative estimate on the actual effect of this air quality policy on mortality via a mechanism that's arguably hard to politically manipulate. And that would be pretty dramatic. That would be, then you could, of course, compare that to cost. Now, for an outcome like this, we need not just to know the benefit, we also need to know the cost. And for the cost, we would need some measure of the expected cost of compliance with this change in the standard. If we had national markets in emissions trading for these kinds of emissions, then we could use the price in an emissions trading market as a measure, as a good, decent measure of the cost of compliance. And then we could make a reasonable judgment there, but because we have limited numbers of markets, we would have to extrapolate from the markets that there are to the markets where they aren't and make some judgments in order to use this, which just goes to show that when you have fewer visible outcomes, these mechanisms have more of a problem. So we could apply this mechanism more straightforwardly to, say, global warming, because there the outcomes people are talking about are pretty visible. Changes in sea levels, changes in temperatures, things like that. The policies they're talking about are pretty visible. Carbon taxes, et cetera, so that this could apply there. The main problem there is it's just a long time scale until you pay off the bets. It might not be the first thing you want to do to show the mechanism works, but it's a great place to use it. But in general, the problem with applying this kind of mechanism in environmental policy is, first of all, as we mentioned before, the whole idea is that this is a reliable, robust source that people can go to and trust when they don't understand and they aren't experts and they're trying to avoid partisan bias, because this can provide them that. But the public doesn't yet see them that way. And until they do, it's not clear whether they'll support or even allow the existence of these markets. Secondly, sometimes we lack clear, distinct policy choices. The EPA does various things, and various judgments are made, and a new person's in charge, and there's some shift in the style of regulation, et cetera, but it's not easily measured. And then it'll be hard to have a decision market on those hard-to-measure decisions. But when we have a bill passed or a clear, big policy, then those things we could do. And we also need sufficient advance warning of the policy. Right? If suddenly the EPA announces something tomorrow and then we just had no anticipation they were ever going to do something like that, then we couldn't have a market 2 weeks ago estimating what would happen if they did that. So we need some warning about the policies that are likely to happen. And then finally, we need these outcomes that can be observed, which for large policies are the health outcomes, the fires, et cetera, sort of outcomes, those are relatively visible, but the cost of compliance and other sorts of preferences affected are harder to observe. Thank you.
To learn more about free market environmentalism, visit www.perc.org.